So we want to really make clear that none of us is alone, that for the first time historically, certainly my lifetime, the first time there is really a democracy movement that is bringing together people from all issues, from labor to environment to democracy itself, but we're coming together in this movement of movement and realizing that we don't have to give up our individual passions.
That's Frances Moore LePay, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Frances Moore LePay, who's best known for her book Diet for a Small Planet, has co-authored a book along with Adam Eichen. He's a political researcher and organizer. They join me to talk about their book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Frances and Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Give us an overview of this book. What are readers going to find here?
Well, a lot of solutions to what many of us feel is the underlying problem, and that is that our democracy is really broken, that there's way too much influence, too much control from an elite, and that is not just our view, that's the vast majority of us. 80% of us really feel that the wealthy have too much influence in our political system. So we are really focused on solutions. That's what the book is about.
Now, the two of you are from different generations, yet you found common ground to write this book. How did your collaboration come together?
Well, it actually began the first conference on international money and politics in Mexico City in the fall of 2015. And Frances and I actually just happened to be at the airport at the same time waiting for the shuttle. And that began a conversation about democracy. And really, since that moment, you know, we spent the conference talking, and then we kind of crossed paths a couple of times. And it really, you know, we developed this deep conversation about what we saw was wrong with democracy in America and what we really saw as a solution to how we could fix it. And it was, you know, this book came together in April 2016 when we were both marching in what was called Democracy Spring. It was this big mobilization of, over 100 different organizations coming together to fight for voting rights and getting big money out of politics. It was a march from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C., and it was there that Frankie and I began our real conversations about what we saw as what we needed to write.
Exactly. A lot of time to talk when you walk. And during that walk, we realized that what was changing us, what was so exciting, even thrilling, we call it the thrill of democracy in our book, was the internal changes that were happening inside of us, as we bonded with people that we'd never meet in ordinary life, as we realized that we did have power, that we felt that we became owners of our democracy by stepping up in that way. And we found that we had more courage than we thought, which has really propelled us forward. So that march really shaped this book. And the next to the last chapter is called The Thrill of Democracy, that it's not just this dull duty, but it's an exciting and rewarding way of life.
Well, I want to talk more about the democracy movement, which you describe as really a movement of movements, in a moment. But first of all, the flip side of that, you describe what you call an anti-democracy movement in America, which you trace back to 1971. Tell us about that.
Correct. I mean, it all really began when Lewis Powell, who would soon become a Supreme Court justice, was commissioned by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to write a memo about how does the corporate point of view, the businessman point of view, get back into American politics. Because as he writes, the American businessman is one of the least heard voices in U.S. politics, as funny as that is to hear today. So he writes this memo, and it becomes basically a playbook for corporations and extremely wealthy individuals of how they can get their voice heard in American politics, and eventually, as it has become, to dominate American politics. And basically, we outline eight strategies. We call them eight strategies of highly effective billionaires. And the ways in which the tactics that these individuals and corporations have used to dominate our political life. And we divide it into two main categories. The first is manipulating the mindset, basically trying to change or alter the ways that Americans think about politics. And the second part is rigging the rules, actually changing the rules of our elections and democracy to make it easier to overwhelm public consensus and really make sure that the business point of view and the wealthy point of view is the only view that's heard.
One of the things that defines politics right now is the gridlock in government. Many Americans are frustrated by this. The political divide is so deeply divided. How did we get to this point?
Well, I want to start our answer to that with this observation that picks up right on what Adam was saying, that maybe the most powerful effect of this anti-democracy movement has been to delegitimize government itself. And we've seen, studying the record, the public record, is there was a concerted attempt, as Ronald Reagan put it, that government is the enemy. You know, government is not the solution, it's the problem. And we've seen this decline in valuing and understanding that government is our voice. It's the way that we can solve problems together. And so this delegitimizing government has been a key factor in getting us to where we are and getting us to the apparent divisions or the polarization, the divided nature that so many people talk about. And I just want to say on that that it was really kind of scary for us to read Newt Gingrich, for example, Republican leader in the 80s and 90s, who said that we really are in a political war that must be fought with the duration and the savagery of civil war. And the goal is not to persuade your enemy, but to destroy the other side's fighting power. So that is not democracy. Democracy is reasoning together and coming up with what can be serving the general public. That is the goal of our Constitution. So I want to start there. And that is really why I think we have the appearance today of such division. But we underline in our book, as I began too, that there is also a lot of common ground, that almost 70% of us believe that public financing, getting big private money out of the picture and people being able to run who aren't wealthy, that is a key part of the solution. So there's a lot of common ground, and that's a key point in our book.
And I'll also just quickly add that it's extremely easy. I mean, there are numerous studies that show that it's very easy for wealthy individuals and corporations to block policy. One of the reasons that we have such gridlock is because it's really easy in our system to, you know, find points to block progress. And so you only need to, you know, give contributions or help support a couple senators or, you know, a couple politicians to block policy. So one of the real key reasons for gridlock is also the amount of money in politics, that it's a great way to block popular will.
That is very different than the assumption that somehow we are a divided people, that gridlock does not mean that we as a people don't agree on a great number of issues, even things like climate change. The majority of us think that government should be acting to limit carbon emissions, for example. And across the board, there is so much agreement.
I guess that would be part of the source of frustration. If you see there is agreement among the populace, but you're not seeing that among the people who are supposed to represent you, how do we change that?
Well, I think that's one of the, you know, the reasons we wrote this book. I would say that's probably the key reason we wrote this book, is there are a lot of books. You know, we don't claim to have done any of the investigative reporting to chronicle what we call the anti-democracy movement. But the reporting that we did, the reason we wrote this book, is because we wanted to highlight what are the solutions to this problem and to describe the movement that is already out there in the streets and in the state houses fighting for these reforms. So there are numerous ways, and I think that the number two ways, the two top ways, are making sure the people who are voting represent the actual populace and getting big money out of politics. And we know how to do that. To get big money out of politics, the Supreme Court says we can't really limit how much, you know, a wealthy individual gives or at least spends independently of a political candidate. But we can, as Frankie was saying, increase the voice of ordinary Americans, whether it's in Maine, which passed clean elections, or in Seattle, which has what's called democracy vouchers, where every resident, every voter gets four $25 vouchers that they can give to any eligible candidate. They don't have to spend any money. They get the money and they can give it to support the candidate. We know that works to diversifying the views that are heard, to diversifying the candidates. We know how to make sure or to expand political voice in our system. Mm-hmm. And in terms of expanding the right to vote, expanding who is voting, we know what to do then too as well. There's this new phenomenon that's sweeping the nation called automatic voter registration. Oregon became the first state. It basically is a way of easing the how to register to vote. And Oregon was the first state to adopt this. And in the first 3 months, the number of new registrants tripled in each of the first 3 months. So the electorate expanded. It was more representative of Oregonians. And so it eased the entry point into how to get involved in the political system. And we know things like same-day registration and other different types of reforms that we chronicle in the book are great ways to start this process of making our political system actually represent the public.
And Maine is a great example of that, where now Maine, that has a system of public financing, it has the largest percentage of working-class people in the state legislature. You know, you can't prove cause and effect, but they've been able to pass very effective environmental law, for example, that kept a lot of lead out of the environment in Maine, and that had been previously opposed by corporations. They didn't want to take responsibility for recycling their electronic equipment, but it passed. And similarly, in Connecticut, with public financing, they were able to pass mandated sick leave, which had been opposed beforehand by somebody who didn't run with public money. So there's real evidence that not only are more people included, more a diversity of people who can run for office, but policies change as well, more in line with the majority view.
And let me just quickly say that this is not some sort of just a liberal issue here. I mean, one, I want your listeners to know that we know what policies we need. We know what to fight for. But two, the people who are passing these types of reforms, we're not just talking about Massachusetts where we are right now. That's not the point. That's totally not the point here. That, you know, one of my favorite examples is South Dakota. In 2016, via ballot initiative, South Dakota passed one of the most sweeping pieces of anti-corruption legislation in the country. And South Dakota has voted for a Republican candidate in 80% of all statewide elections since it became a state in, I think, 1824, right? So it's conservatives and liberals are both frustrated and know what policies to fight for here. You know, it's much more of a question of making sure we know that we can spread awareness of the fact that we have these policies and continue to foster a movement to create more momentum for them.
Another thing you talk about in the book, you know, if you've dealt with voters' rights, you've dealt with the money issue, you still have to deal with the framework, and that's the Electoral College and the impact it has on elections.
True. And there's a very interesting, innovative, clever approach here that is a workaround. Yes, a constitutional amendment down the road can be a fix, but right now we are more than halfway toward a workaround. It's called the National Popular Vote, where states, I believe it's 11 states that combined add up to 165 electoral college votes, which is more than half, to get you there. They have committed, once there are enough to really make it effective nationally, they are committed to ensure that their votes go to the candidate who gets the national popular vote victory nationally, right? And so it's a way that we can have the popular vote determining the presidential election even without changing the Constitution. As I say, 11 very significant states of a lot of electoral votes are on board with that. So even there is a way we can move forward.
Well, there's so much more in this book that we don't have time to cover in this brief interview. But for those who do pick up the book, how do you hope that they will use the information in the book?
I mean, I think, at least for me, I just want people to see that we know what to do. And we just want to encourage people to get out there and have their voices heard and to fight for democracy. I think that's to join the democracy movement. In every state across the country, there are people fighting for all of the types of reforms that we talk about in the book. And I think that, you know, finding your entry point is incredibly important, especially in a place like Kansas, where there's more than enough ways to expand democracy and to fight against anti-democratic measures like citizenship requirements to register to vote or interstate cross-check program, which is shown to purge many more voters than it is to ensure safety.
And so we want to really make clear that none of us is alone, that for the first time historically, certainly my lifetime, the first time there is really a democracy movement that is bringing together people from all issues, from labor to environment to democracy itself, but we're coming together in this movement of movements and realizing that we don't have to give up our individual passion, say, for environment in order to be part of this. In fact, we bring that passion to this movement, and it's incredibly enriching. It's not asking people to carry a burden, but to get out, let despair go. We make the assertion that hope itself has power, because hope allows our brains to orient us towards solutions. And there is this very hope-filled, energetic, very inspiring movement underway. And fieldguidetodemocracy.org fieldguidetodemocracy.org is a new online platform we're creating with others to show people this is happening and to help people find where they can plug in. It's still under development, but that is an honest way to really being a useful tool for anybody, anywhere.
Thank you both for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'm delighted.
Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen's book is Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. More interviews and a wide variety of topics are available at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You'll find us on Facebook at KPR Conversations, and you can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.